I'm Mark Olson, and I'm editor of a magazine called The Other Side. Copies of the magazine are available if you want to see them, I think, in the Resource Center over there, and there are also some for sale in the bookstore. In fact, I think I'm going to, if any of you would like to take one of these little sheets that tells something about The Other Side and has a form for subscribing at half price, if you want to do that, you can take it. If you don't want the sheet, just pass them on.
Great magazine.
Let's begin with a word of prayer. Grant us, Lord, not to be anxious about earthly things, but to love things heavenly. And even now, while we are placed among things that are passing away, to hold fast here to those that shall endure. Through Jesus Christ we pray. Amen. I apologize to those of you who may have been regular readers of The Other Side. You may have heard, you may have read some of what I have to say tonight earlier. On a hot Sunday afternoon, one November a few years ago, I sat in the back of a sweltering van as the sweaty and somewhat smelly group that I was with, which included Dan back here, bounced its way down a lonely dirt road in the interior of the Dominican Republic. All around us were fields as far as the eye could see, green with sugar cane, tall and straight, waving in the breeze. It's been a few years now since that visit to the Dominican sugar fields. Yet that dusty Sunday afternoon still troubles me, for it brought me face to face with horror, a horror that many of us, myself included, have no idea how to deal with. Yet as I've reflected on that horror, I've also found new empathy for a strange and often puzzling passage of Scripture, a passage that many of us, I fear, would rather ignore. Like many Americans, I knew that sugar was the Dominican Republic's major export. I knew it was the heart of its agricultural industry. But before going to the Dominican Republic that November, I had little idea of how that industry worked. A dozen sugar plantations, vast in size, sprawl across the Dominican countryside. The Dominican government owns most of them. When it comes to running the plantations and managing the operation, Dominicans don't mind doing their bit, nor do Dominicans mind putting in their time at the old ramshackle mills where the sugar is processed and prepared for export, mostly to the United States, but I understand as of recently also to the Soviet Union. But there's one job Dominicans won't take on their own, the job of cutting the cane, working the fields, and enduring that hot, blazing sun. To Dominicans, that's demeaning work, dangerous work, dreaded work. No self-respecting Dominican wants to do it. You see, Dominicans, with their brown skin and Spanish language, tend to think of themselves as Europeans. And for most Dominicans, there's only one kind of people fit for that kind of work. Only one kind of people fit for cutting cane, lugging ton after ton of it from the fields on their backs. They called them Africans. For decades, the Dominican government literally bought Haitian human beings to cut its cane, bought them at $100 a body from Jean-Claude Duvalier, Haiti's now deposed president for life. Year after year, without blinking an eye, Duvalier sold his own people to the Dominican sugar fields to work under conditions he himself could never imagine. Today, he and his family are still living on the French Riviera, enjoying in part the money he made from such business. And it was to one of those Dominican one of the Dominican Republic's vast sugar plantations that we were headed that Sunday afternoon. Frequently, I'm told, foreigners aren't allowed near the fields or the little batays where the cutters live. Managers are understandably paranoid about agitators or union organizers. But this Sunday afternoon, early one November, no guards seemed to be in place, and our group slowly, ever so slowly, made its way into the heart of this evil. I don't know how to tell you how unimaginable the conditions were. Many of the cane cutters live in long concrete bunkers, sometimes as many as 10 or 12 hot, miserable people per room. When they arrive, they're given two things: a thin piece of foam rubber on which to sleep, and a 1 gallon plastic milk container to fetch water for themselves from the polluted streams and rivers that meander through the fields. They live in what most of us would call absolute squalor. As we got off our little van, I could hardly open my eyes. I felt my hands tremble. At one batay, we gathered under an open thatch roof, one of the few signs of shade anywhere. Earlier, I suspected Christians at this batay may have gathered to worship the God that we and they so deeply love. But now, with a van of strangers arriving, they and others eagerly gathered again to share in loud and often agitated voices the story of their agony. Over the turmoil, the lay leader of the Batay's little community struggled to vocalize the cutter's concerns. His eyes couldn't focus in the same direction at the same time, and an old pair of ill-fitting glasses, probably cast off from someone who had gotten some new, hung in a lopsided way across his nose. "We're slaves," he trembled. "Nothing but slaves. They work us like animals." All around me were angry, frantic voices, repeating the same message. Cries of slavery, cries of desperation, cries of exploitation. At the height of the harvest, they told us, they work from 3 a.m. till 8 p.m, 7 days a week. There are no coffee breaks, no lunch breaks, no dinner breaks. There are no toilets, no air conditioners, no water fountains. To eat when they get home, if there's anything to eat. Sometimes, one man said, all they can manage is hot water with a little salt in it. When they can, they grow food for themselves in back parts of the fields, hoping against hope it won't be discovered or destroyed. Good hands, I was told, cut 3 to 4 tons of cane a day, hauling it from the fields on their back. Ah, yes, they are paid for their work, if you can call it that. After the usual cheating by the owners at the scales, 17 hours of cutting might yield the average worker $1.75 in pay for the day. Less than $2 for 3 tons of cane. Fortunately, they aren't paid in cash. They're paid in vouchers, redeemable for cash in 2 weeks' time. But who can wait 2 weeks to eat? So in desperation, many are forced to turn in their vouchers at the company store, where they promptly lose 10% in value. Other times, workers are stolen from one plantation to another, just picked up and hauled off to work somewhere else. Well, I listen to their stories in horror. Surely, I thought, there is something they can do. Surely there is something, someone they can protest to, some legal remedy. I guess it's endemic for us educated, well-privileged North American activists to assume that something can be done. But I was told that Haitians in the Dominican Republic have no legal rights. They're not eligible for citizenship. They cannot own land. Their children die like flies. They cannot take anyone to court. If they protest at the scales, they're thrown in prison. They can be shoved off buses anytime Dominican wants their space. Medical care, available at low cost to almost everyone else, is often not available when they show up. And the more they talked, the more evident were their feelings, the more evident was their desperation. "We have no hope," they cried. "No hope at all." And we who talk about discipleship and economic justice, we have a hard time dealing with situations like this. What do you do when someone looks you in the face and says they have no hope at all? When they turn to you and say, slavery is not dead? What do you do when there's no solution in sight? No hope of change anywhere you can think of? What are justice seekers supposed to do when an evil is this entrenched, when every effort at economic change ends in failure? Mostly, I fear, we turn our backs and slip away, as I myself did that afternoon. Mostly, I fear, we strike the reality from our mind and pretend it doesn't exist. It doesn't conform with our image of the world, a world in which love and justice will triumph if only we'll do our best, a world in which all wrongs can be quickly and simply righted if only a few of us will act in faith. We'd rather tackle those situations where justice looks like it might be just around the corner. There's nothing like success. Perhaps that's why we also shun certain biblical passages. Take this one, a story which appears without fail in all three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but never once from any of the gospels makes it into any of the three-year ecumenical lectionaries of Sunday readings that I have seen. This is the story from Luke 9. Now it happened that on that following day, when Jesus and the disciples were coming down from the mountain, a large crowd came to meet him. Suddenly a man in the crowd cried out, "Master," he said, "I implore you to look at my son. He is my only child. A spirit will suddenly take hold of him, and all at once it gives a sudden cry and throws the boy into convulsions with foaming at the mouth. It is slow to leave him, but when it does, it leaves the boy worn out. I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not." In reply, Jesus said, "Faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be among you and put up with you? Bring your son here." Even while the boy was coming, the devil threw him to the ground in convulsions. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and cured the boy and gave him back to his father. And everyone was awestruck by the greatness of God. I don't know about you, but that line in the passage about the disciples being begged to drive out the evil spirit, but finding that, quote, "they could not," unquote, somehow offends me every time I read it. In the pursuit of love and justice and compassion, I don't want to acknowledge brick walls. I don't want to believe that determined action by faithful disciples won't always bring liberation. Indeed, not long ago, when I used this passage in a worship setting, I found myself changing the words "could not" to "did not." That made the passage better conform to my view of the world. The problem was no longer that the disciples tried to do something and failed. No, with my subtle rewriting, the story was changed to imply that the disciples were confronted with suffering, knew that they should have acted, and yet did nothing. That's the kind of sin that I like to talk about. But that's not what this story is about. It's about faithful disciples, empowered by God, who reached out with all that they had to do something about the suffering of innocent people. They did their best, and they failed. They made not the slightest dent in the suffering of that child. They wanted to help, but they could not. The evil before them wouldn't budge. And you know, more often than we like to admit, that's the kind of world we live in. A world where evil, especially economic evils and social evils, they won't budge. We, like the disciples, live in a world of violent convulsions. It's a world in which all too often nothing we do seems to make any difference. We search in vain for options, yet hunger flares. Oppression beats on, slavery reemerges, and military interventions continue. We're worn out with crying, we're worn out with trying. We wanted to drive out the source of all suffering. We wanted to bring hope and life, but we could not. Despite our dreams and illusions, this gospel story seems to say evil is real. Sin runs deep. It afflicts us not just individually, but collectively. Faithless and perverse generation, cries Jesus. How much longer must I be among you? How much longer must I put up with you? You can call it original sin or collective guilt or entrenched structures. Call it what you like. But until our work for justice is grounded not just in an awareness of our Creator's blessing and Jesus' will, but also in a recognition of our own perversity, until we recognize with honesty the pervasiveness and persistence of an unclean spirit in our midst, we are out of touch with reality. There is indeed a power beyond our hands, a possessive evil, as it were, that irresistibly drives our world. Again and again, that spirit throws us to the ground, grinds our face in the dirt, and leaves us writhing in wretched and disgusting convulsions. We are all victimized by it, but it seems to pick most on the poor, on the weak, on the despised, especially in some of those unfathomable countries that we would just as soon not talk about. All of this is embarrassing, of course. It offends my "leave it to me, I've got it under control" spirit. It undermines my middle-class North American managerial mentality. It confronts me with my own complicity, my own inadequacy. With neighbors around the world, indeed with the disciples of old, I have to turn to Jesus, my head hung in shame. "Lord, I couldn't do it. I tried, I pushed, I struggled, but I didn't make it." How agonizing that is. I'll tell you something. One of the hardest things I've done was to get back on that van at the end of that afternoon and ride away, knowing I was leaving behind people in near slavery, people so exploited and economically oppressed, so buried under structures so deep that neither they nor I had the slightest idea how to find a shred of hope. I wasn't depressed just over their situation. I was depressed over mine. I had no answers. I saw no solutions. I was unarguably and irrevocably at wit's end. Where, in the name of heaven, can such people here on earth turn? Many of the poor have known long where they can turn. When they've done all they can, when they've struggled on and on and on and still can't break free, when the power of evil has them cornered, many know that there's still one who listens, still one who cares, still one who reaches out in love. His name is Jesus. To those of us who are rich and white and educated and strong, sometimes that's offensive. We call it pie in the sky. We call it romantic nonsense. We don't trust stuff we can't get our hands on, stuff we can't take charge of. We want the spirituality of Christianity without the power. without the reality, without any recognition of our own inadequacies. Is it any wonder that Jesus said it would be easier for a camel to squeeze through the eye of a needle than it would be for rich, self-confident folks like us to make our way into God's kingdom? The Father, says Luke in the story, the Father took his troubled son to Jesus. It wasn't a quiet, polite taking. I get the feeling he was screaming with desperation. The Father admitted his failures. He had done what he could. So had the disciples, those proud, arrogant, eager-to-please creatures who traipsed after Jesus, dreaming of which of them would someday sit at his right hand. Nothing had worked. The convulsion still came. The suffering still went on. The child still ached. The evil wouldn't stop. Jesus gathered the boy into his arms, rebuked the unclean spirit, cured the child, and graciously returned him to his father. And everyone, says Luke, was awestruck by the greatness of God. And there sometimes is the rub. We'd rather have folks awestruck by us. Our consistent ideologies, our revolutionary behaviors, our nonviolent resistance, our at oneness with the world, our persistence in the face of adversity, our creatively formed organizations, our clever strategies, our economic and political boycotts, our faithful and generous giving, and of course, our determined dealing with what we see as the true roots of injustice. And of course, we are called to action. We are called to hear the cries of the despairing. We are called to give voice to the voiceless. We are called to unpress the oppressed. In short, we are called to run down all those tough and demanding paths that Christ has so successfully run before us. Yes, in a world of convulsions, in a world of evil spirits still exploiting and destroying, we are called to greatness. But the greatness we are called to is the greatness of God, who so graciously heals all our diseases, binds all our wounds, frees all our captives, and shows us the way that we should live. We worship not some distant, uninvolved spiritual force whose only role is to calm the nerves of sophisticated, withered people who can otherwise manage on their own. We have a God who is at work in our world, whose strong arms break yokes, open eyes, and roll back stones. In one way or another, every victory is God's victory. But I'm still haunted. I'm still haunted by faces from that Sunday afternoon on the plantation. I can still see one fellow sitting so quietly, even peacefully it seemed, on the hot concrete in front of his miserable pate quarters, surrounded by swarms of naked and half-naked children. Many seemed malnourished and disfigured. Few, I suspect, will live to adulthood. An infant sat crying on the man's lap, tears running down its cheeks. In an effort to quiet its hunger, the child sucked plaintively on an old piece of sugar cane. I watched its eyes fixed on mine. The man on whose lap the child sat wore a baseball cap, the battered visor pulled down to shade his eyes. Initially, I was so overwhelmed by the situation that I didn't notice what was pinned to the front of his cap. It was a little handmade metal cross, that emblem of suffering and shame. I don't know if the man survived that sugar season or the next or the next. I understand that cane cutters make it through more than 12 to 15 harvests, but I know this, that as he suffered, Christ suffered. That African working in slavery on a Dominican sugar plantation is not just wearing a cross. He is himself a living crucifix. And the God that we worship, the God whose awesome greatness can indeed overwhelm the tenacious evil around us, this God will not let Christ's suffering go unnoticed. This God will not stand idly by while all hope is lost. Darkness may fall, and the best of us may despair, but there shall be a resurrection in the morning. The stone shall be rolled away, the clouds shall break, and the structures of oppression, structures which have afflicted so many generations, this generation and all generations, those structures shall know victory no more. This God of the coming victory, promises to lead us to the other side of the Jordan, away from the heat of economic oppression, away from years of economic despair, into a new land, a land flowing with milk and honey. That's not an imaginary land, not some place over in Never Never Land. We're talking about concrete realities, real justice, real hope, real change. Oh yes, the road is long. The hills are high. The journey's rough. Like the disciples, we'll wander and fall along the way. But Jesus can lead us on, I believe. As slaves and ex-slaves in our own country know so well, when the chips are down and down and down, when all roads seem blocked, he alone will take our hand. He alone will help us stand. Jesus' power, more than ours, is real. To be a faithful generation in a world of economic inequality and great suffering, perhaps we must be a desperate generation. We must know that our own work for peace, justice, and compassion, our own work, urgent as it is not enough. We must take a lesson from the poor, the oppressed, and the forgotten. While working and striving and struggling, we must also carry our horrors to heaven. We must acknowledge our trembling hands and stumbling feet. And we must, at last, cry out to Jesus to help us. Faithless and perverse generation, sighed Jesus. How much longer must I put up with you? Bring the child here. Bring the child here. Jesus' words on money appear throughout the Gospels. All kinds of hard words. There's no economic system proposed, no solution to the great economic injustice and oppression that was the lot of his people. But it's clear that in all that he taught and all that he said, he was calling his disciples, he was calling those of us who would be part of God's kingdom, to be on the side of the victims, to be on the side of those whose lot seems so hopeless. And that's not an easy side to be on. But it calls for us, even in the midst of a system we don't like, even in the midst of a world we can't stand, to find ways where we are, to dream new visions and to hope new hopes, to begin living in our own way, where we are, in a new way, and to call those around us to conversion, to repentance, to living in God's new way as well. And yet, I know that for myself and for most of the Christians I know, it's very hard to start doing that. And so I sort of want to open it up a little bit at this point to see if there are any things that you want to talk about or suggest or reflect on about Jesus and money and how you see yourself or others of us struggling to respond and what options you see. Does anyone have any comments or questions you want to raise or reflections you want to share? I can suggest some things to talk about if you don't have something right now. You know, it's a strange economic world that we live in, both here in the United States and around the world, because all of the parts are interrelated. And I've sort of come to believe that what we have is what I call a lottery economy. Practically every state, it seems like, I don't know if all the states, but many of the states have set up lotteries these days. And you know how they work. People go and buy little tickets or something, and there's great interest in that. And they pay out their money in the hopes that they'll win some big jackpot. You know, and some of the jackpots have been millions of dollars. But very, very few ever come up with those million-dollar jackpots. And everybody else puts in their money and lose. Seems to me that's something like the economic system we have in this world. We put in our little bits of money, our labor, our efforts, and we keep playing the game because we think we might be one of those few winners. Those million-dollar jackpots might go home with us. And we become addicted to it. And we live with great injustice, even for ourselves, because we might be one of those winners. And just like the lotteries run through a lot of advertising, convincing people that there's going to be a million-dollar winner, I think there's a lot of effort to keep us working in this lottery economy. There was a recent poll done in the United States, and it found that the number of people in the United States that now see economic inequality as, quote, a problem, unquote, is at one of the lowest levels since they began asking that question. It's down to 28%. 72% don't see economic inequality as a problem, even though 72% obviously include a whole lot of people that are below average in their income, some considerably below. And I wonder if we don't have this lottery mentality that we'll somehow make it. And that those people who have so much less, maybe they'll make it. And maybe those poor folks cutting sugar cane, maybe they'll make it. Maybe the jackpot will come to them. I don't know. But what makes us so accepting of what we have in our world? Anybody have any ideas?
You don't have to have a lot of contact with it. Most of us are pretty distant from poverty. You don't have to confront it on a daily basis. And without that reality before us, it's pretty easy to not think it exists.
You know what, I think also we don't know about, that we don't have the contact with poverty. I think it also works because, and maybe you wouldn't agree, but maybe it also works because we don't have contact with the real wealth either. If we were to see the real wealth side by side with the real poverty, it would be all the more gross, I think. I think it's important that both of those are hidden.
We were talking about some of these things in David Anderson's session this morning, but I also think one of the real problems I see, I think money is just one of the hardest topics to talk about anywhere. It seems the last thing that ever comes up in a church. And it's partly because it is really a deeply intimate thing. It really tells us about where we place our values. And I think in my own case, I'm often pretty embarrassed about what those values are. But we're so privatized about our money. I mean, it's now, I think, you know, it used to be something like sex was a big taboo, but I think it's easier now to talk about sexuality than to talk about money.
Yeah.
And I gave you an example. I lived in a Christian community household for 3 years with two other people, and we were very close on everything, but never once in those 3 years did we talk about what the three of us earned, except in kind of vague terms. Mm-hmm. I've never had an idea what my parents earned in terms of dollar figures. Children were never included in those discussions. And, and so talking about money is really hard. Mm-hmm. And yet I think it's absolutely essential if we're going to talk about our faith values. Mm-hmm. And yet it's really awkward.
Yeah.
I think maybe this is what you meant by the lottery mentality, mm-hmm. that I had heard this, I don't remember the figures quoted, but that the people you talked about who were below average mm-hmm. in a poll, it was determined that they would rather see the system allow for the chance that they might win that mm-hmm. lottery than to mm-hmm. have justice. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Years ago, when I was taking economics, I learned that 10% of the people had 90% of the wealth. Is that about mm-hmm. the same today? Or is it?
I wish I had those figures on the edge of my mind, but I don't. It's tricky. It depends on how you state that. Have the wealth can mean ownership of things. Sometimes the figures are stated in terms of income, you know, annual incomes, and that the percentages are different depending on which you're looking at. Does anyone know those figures? There's a phenomenal percentage, though, mm-hmm. that's owned of the wealth is owned by and received by the top 5%.
In agriculture, I just remember the figure is that it's about 1.5%. The farm owner earned 97% of the net income from the farm. Mm-hmm. Because there are more mm-hmm. farmers who earn more off mm-hmm. the land than they do in the land. So in this country, is that small figure? So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Just one comment first. Dan's comment about how private we are about money and how difficult it is to talk about. It's interesting because it seemed to me that Jesus was understanding that. It must have been true then too. He talked about the love of money. It's a very private sort of thing in a way, you know, love of money. And loyalty, you can't serve two masters. Those are things that go on in our hearts are
money is just very close to us. Now, societies have varied on how open they are in talking about money and that kind of thing, but there's something about money and about our dealing and failing to deal with economic inequality that gets buried inside us, and there's a sickness in our soul that seems to keep feeding it and keep putting up those walls. Very hard to deal with.
Well, money is kind of a symbol of power.
Yes.
Symbol of being able to control our own destiny. Mm-hmm. It's the primary cause of divorces is the finances that exist, who's going to handle the finances and what control they have. One of the things that bothered me when I came back to this culture is watching how much people try to incorporate in their own house, mm-hmm. and how little they try to do with other human beings, mm-hmm. how little they try to merge and form community. Mm-hmm. And so I see money in this culture as a thing that breeds loneliness, mm-hmm. selfishness, mm-hmm. and yet we can hide in it in our own house with our own television mm-hmm. sets and our own cars and our own things right in our own house. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. I guess I think something that I've been thinking about lately is just that how when we have money, we're in a way able to buy ourselves out of community.
That's right.
Because no longer mm-hmm. it's necessary for us to share ownership of a vehicle mm-hmm. or a tool or something with someone else. When we have money, we can own it all ourselves, and we no longer have to interact with other people. And so in a way, money allows us to buy out of community. And in many ways, at least in this society, it seems that when you don't do that, when you don't take that step to have private ownership of something, that seems very, very, it's suspect's an excellent word for it, mm-hmm. very mm-hmm. suspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, if we can buy out a community right in our local area, we can mm-hmm. buy out a community any place. Right? We can disassociate mm-hmm. ourselves with right. the Haitians or with the South Africans right. because we can buy out right. of our local community.
Yeah. That's
right. Yeah. The worst example of buying out a community would be, finally when Congress decided that there would be no more Contra funding, well, then we went around to a number of people who were rich enough to fund an army mm-hmm. or to fund mm-hmm. money for the Contras, millions of dollars, mm-hmm. like the Coors mm-hmm. and other people like that, who ideologically agreed with that. But mm-hmm. since we had money, it's another way of buying out a community, mm-hmm. just going above the law since mm-hmm. we have the money. And in some ways we kind of respect that, I think.
Yeah.
Or mm-hmm. maybe not respect it, but appreciate mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That helps me identify something that Kirk just said, a struggle, an ongoing struggle I've had. Just to kind of exemplify this, those of us who have been here at Holden for quite a while, long-termers, so-called long-termers, we sometimes get the comments, somebody asks, how long have you been here? And you comment on that, and they say, oh, that's wonderful, as if we've somehow done some special thing. I mean, there's a kind of an undertone of how wonderful that you've sacrificed so much of your potential income. I assume that's part of what they're talking about. And I always feel guilty about that and don't know quite how to respond, because frankly, I ran away from all of that. That was that whole income thing. The Great American Dream scene was something that I found practically burying me. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what to do with that at this point in terms of thinking about mm-hmm. going back in mainstream mm-hmm. society. Mm-hmm. And I guess I've got to work that through, which is part of the reason I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's been part of my tension, because I have been a long-term staff mm-hmm. here, and to go back out and say, what is my responsibility as far as planning for my retirement? How much is enough to save for later if I'm responsible for my future, and if I'm somebody who is capable of having income and taking care of myself in the future, am I responsible to society to see that I do that? Or is my responsibility now to continue to give things away and to live simply and see that people now can live as well as I'm living now? And that's the tension.
Yeah.
I was just going to comment that money is security to people.
Mm-hmm.
I work in an investment company, and we try to tell our clients that even though on a dollar bill it says in God we trust, it's only that dollar bill that people trust in.
Yeah.
And the thought of losing your money is very frightening to people. And people who come in looking for work,
mm-hmm.
for that income capability, mm-hmm. with all the employment mm-hmm. turnover,
mm-hmm.
mergers and all of this sort
mm-hmm.
of thing, the common thread that I see in the applications is I want to work for a stable company,
mm-hmm.
something that will secure my future.
Mm-hmm.
And money is where they sit.
You know, I think that we live in a world that we're not going to change instantly, and yet we have to find a way to live in that world and yet be true to the values that we find ourselves being called to in Scripture and that we see demonstrated by God through Christ. We have to find ways to support each other in a sense, almost developing economic resistance communities
mm-hmm.
that have to operate within the reality in which we are, which we find ourselves, and yet, like Daniel, who found himself sucked into an empire that he had no control over, and a court that he had no real standing in, and yet saying, wait a minute, there's certain things here I'm just not going to eat. There's certain prayers that I am going to make. And there are certain decisions that I think we have to say, well, I know this is how it works in our society, but we're going to do it different. We're going to resist that, and we're going to live as best we can with some other values guiding us. But it's hard. Yeah, you wanted to say something?
Well, you were saying that there's this kind of sickness, and I guess sort of responding to what you were saying, in some ways, the sickness of the privilege in this society strikes me as we really are trying to protect against everything. We want security of all sorts, whether it's national security or income security or health security, or if there's a way to ensure that we won't suffer, we will buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's sort of a difference between the challenge of faith to sort of the economic justice question mm-hmm. that you've been raising and the challenge to us. I mean, one of the reasons maybe it's so hard to talk about and it's so scary is that it's really a question of, do we believe those things that we say in the faith that what we need will be given to us?
Mm-hmm.
How much risk will we run?
Yeah.
And so pretty soon we're right up against a much more of a faith mm-hmm. question. And I think that's right here.
Yeah. Are we going to pursue security for ourselves? Or are we going to pursue security for people who are even in a riskier situation than ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
And we usually choose ourselves, both as a nation and individually.
I think one of the things that at least I can relate to is it's very hard to make it visible in the United States just how wealthy
mm-hmm.
we are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had a chance to travel. Of course, traveling takes money, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had a chance to travel in business. And you know, where you know, some of the things you've seen that their countries are just so terribly poor that to very wealthy people, and that country is not on the same level as our poor people. And so we just get so used to having so much, mm-hmm. we can't see anymore. So mm-hmm. I think visibility helps a lot. One of the tremendous examples, I think, in my life has been a close friend of ours that he has tended to live this more than anyone else that I can ever think of. And he traveled through Ethiopia and India and Bangladesh, and he worked for Lutheran World Relief. And then he's, you know, in his own life, he's adopted people, refugees from various places, including our own country, Vietnamese and Bulgarian refugees. And, I think that helps just to be able to see it. You know, you see it on television, but you can't spend the money to travel, but mm-hmm. we don't understand how wealthy we are. Mm-hmm. I know that.
I'm still thinking about Kirk's comment and how struck I am by how money has become something to really give us what we think we need to have. And to get us, and the frustration that people feel when they're not able to buy that. I mean, I think of the thing you just hear of Holden and how we've made a commitment to, this is a really simple thing, but minimize the use of the vehicles going on the road and using you know very much fuel. And how frustrating it was once for a guest who was up here who had a big business trip and had hiked through and thought he could just pay somebody here to get him down to the boat to meet it. And the level of frustration in this man and how ridiculous he thought we were that we would not accept just some extra money to drive this vehicle down, to give him a special ride out. And how maybe in some ways people wish they could, you know, maybe buy to have a private room here at Holden, or if I just pay more, I can get what I want. There was somebody here at Holden that was talking about a Mennonite community or somewhere where, as a group, people all had a community of some other adults that had to sort of bring their monetary to scrutiny, that they openly shared that with each other annually in some kind of organized way.
And their time,
it was not only just money, but, and it just sounded like a really creative way to have some accountability to one another as Christians and to have that a less private you know, kind of affair.
Maybe churches should require that everyone in the church has someone pick someone else in the church to do their taxes every year.
Go to another church.
Yeah. We don't have very much time. I want to just share a couple brief things. I had a quote here from a political sociologist, he's called, at Stanford, Seymour Martin Lipset. Listen to this. See what you think. He says, for an economic system to work, you have to have unequal rewards.
Do we have to do that?
For an economic system to work, you have to have unequal rewards. Unequal rewards. Yeah.
In all fairness, he didn't say we have to have starting
businesses. No. No, he did not. Same. But you know, what I questions came to my mind when I read that was, what does he mean by work? And work for whom? And work for why? There are certain assumptions that we put into thinking about our economic questions that we need to examine sometimes before we can know whether these statements are really we as Christians should agree to. The next thing I wanted to just share a brief quote is from this book. It's called House of Disciples, Church Economics and Justice in Matthew. It's an interesting and provocative book by Michael Crosby. It's over at the bookstore. he takes the view that Matthew is really about economics addressed to the households of Matthew's day that were worshiping in economic units. He also is of the opinion that all this stuff that we hear about sometimes about Jesus being poor, you know, born in a stable and all that, that's a lot of nonsense. He thinks Jesus and the disciples were middle class, carpenters, fisher people, and tax collectors. These were not poor people. And he thinks that Matthew is really addressed to, in a sense, sort of middle class economic units. And that the challenge of Jesus conveyed through Matthew is to those units to respond in a different way than they were. This is just a brief quote from the book. Today, he says, as in the day of Matthew's Jesus, the heart of the people seems to have grown hard toward conversion, especially the hearts of the prosperous, who are called to work to bring good news to the poor in the form of justice. While many people of the middle and upper classes are generous with their time and service on behalf of the poor, and others make individual contributions, when it comes to changing the terms of the relationship between the rich and the poor, hardness of heart all too often seems to develop. Few among the prosperous, in our day as in Jesus' day, are open to forms of redistribution of power and wealth that will manifest a just social order. I think that's true. Anything else anyone wants to say before we close? I just want to say, anyone who wants a little form about The Other Side magazine, pick one up here at the table if you didn't get one that's passed around. But anything else that anyone wanted to say before? We have just 1 minute, according to my watch.
Can anybody send this book? Can you hear that the author of that book is going to be speaking at Gonzaga University the first weekend in July?
Oh.
It's supposed to be really good.
I didn't hear why you're promoting The Other Side.
Oh, The Other Side. I'm the editor. So I have an interest. I have a financial interest.
Really economic problem here.
So. Okay. Well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
We do subscribe. We have renewed it.